My name's Jonathan. I'm the preaching minister here, if you're a guest here today. And I love getting to do this job. I sincerely love preaching. I love so much about what I get to do. But it's kind of a weird experience when you tell people what it is that you do. So, I don't know, a few years ago, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, I was on a flight leaving Dallas or coming to Dallas. I can't remember, but the lady sitting next to me told me she was going to Vegas. And she told me what she was going to do in Vegas. She was planning on hitting the slots, betting big on black, doing all the Vegas things. And then she said, "What do you do for a living?" And I told her, and immediately it changed. Her travel plans changed. It was actually that she had an aunt who was a senior, and she was going to go there so she could bless her and take care of her. And, you know, bless her senior aunt in the nursing home. And I say that to say it's weird how weird people get when you tell them that you're a preacher. Women button up an extra button on their blouse. People change. I kid you not. People change their vocabulary. People try to hide their cigarettes. And I'm not talking about their pack of cigarettes. I'm talking about, and I've seen this, their lit cigarette. It's weird how weird people get when they find out what I do. And sometimes this will happen. Sometimes people will start explaining their life decisions to me. Like, well, I haven't been to church in a while because of what, you know, this is going on. Or sometimes people will even start to confess stuff they feel bad about. But most of the time, especially in the Bible Belt, what happens is it shuts down a conversation, or at least a real conversation. People get distant. And this is what I hate about my job. What I hate about my job, and I think it's especially damning for American churches, is that when people find out what I do, they immediately don't want to be real. The reason I think it's so damning to American churches is because our failure to preach the real gospel and celebrate the grace of Jesus Christ has made us more like the people Jesus stood against than like Jesus. Because, and I hope as we've been going through the Gospel of Luke, Gospel, the story of Jesus, as we've been doing this, I hope you've started to see that people who were nothing like Jesus liked Jesus. And they knew he liked them. It was the reason he was constantly in trouble with the religious leaders of his day, because he was hanging out with the, people that the good, upstanding people of the day wouldn't spend time with. So today we're getting to my favorite chapter in the entire Bible. It is the chapter through which I view the rest of the Bible through. I kid you not. I read every verse in the Bible through the lens of this chapter that we're talking about today. I view life through the chapter that we're talking about today. But before we can get there, we have to go a couple of other places first. Because I want you to know the people Jesus was talking to. These days, origin stories are a real big deal. How many of you in the last year have watched a superhero movie origin story? Okay, yeah. Probably more than that. Come on, be honest. But like, for example, Spider-Man. There have been, in the last 10 years, 3 origin reboots of Spider-Man. It's like, hey, we know how this happened. The guy got bit by a spider, and it got superpowers. But the most famous origin story of all, in all of human history, is one that we often forget. And it has a lot to do with you and why you're here this morning. It's the story of one of the first families in history. It's in the first book of the Bible, and it takes 2/3 of that book. It starts with a guy named Isaac, and Isaac has 2 sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau was actually the firstborn, and the way Genesis describes Esau is that he's this manly man, he's a hunter, and he's really hairy. The actual Hebrew for Esau is Chewbacca. I mean, this guy is just a manly man. And he's got a brother who's the opposite of that. His brother's name is Jacob. And Jacob, the way Genesis describes Jacob, is that he lived among the tents, which is a Hebrew idiom that means he likes scrapbooking and pottery making. Like Esau is the alpha male and Jacob is not that. And one time Esau goes off hunting and he comes back and he's hungry. And if you know guys like Esau, and living in Arkansas, you know guys like Esau. The one thing they want to be, they don't want to be when they come back from hunting is hungry. And Jacob, like he's Goldilocks, is cooking some pottage. And Esau comes back and he says, I'm so hungry, I've got to have some of that. And Jacob sees a vulnerability in his brother and he says, okay, I'll give you some of this soup if you'll give me your birthright. Now, if you were a Jewish boy or girl when you were first hearing that story, you would gasp, because that meant that birthright meant that you're giving up two-thirds of the inheritance. You're going to get just a third of the inheritance as the firstborn. You're going to give up your right to two-thirds of the inheritance. And furthermore, you're going to make him the patriarch of the family. But Jacob, who would later go into selling timeshares, sees his moment and exploits it. And Esau says yes. A couple chapters later, Isaac, the dad, is dying. He's blind and he can't see. So he tells Esau, I want you to go off and hunt for me. Bring me back some food the way I like it. And when you come back, I'm going to give you the dying father's firstborn blessing. But the mother, Rebekah, likes Jacob more than she likes Esau. So she says, Jacob, go pretend to be Esau. Go up to your blind dad and get the firstborn blessing. And Jacob, who's aware of the body dissimilarity, says to his mom, hey, I think dad would notice I'm not hairy old Esau. And so she says, you're right. Here's what we're going to do. Take a goat skin and put it on you. Wrap your arms and your hands with goat fur. And then when your dad feels you, he'll think you're Esau. I'd like to pause at this point in the story and ask the question, how hairy is Esau that this is a viable option? And it works. Jacob goes to Esau dressed in goat skin. His dad fills him and he goes, there's my boy. There's Esau. But when he goes to his dad to get the blessing, here's what he actually says in Genesis chapter 27. Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her older son, which she had in her house, and put them on her younger son, Jacob. She also covered his hands and a smooth part of his neck with the goat skins. Then she handed her son Jacob the tasty food and the bread she had made. He went to his father and said, my father, yes, my son, he answered. Who is it? I am Esau. Liar, liar, goat's hair on fire. And when Esau comes back and realizes that Jacob has now got the firstborn birthright and the firstborn blessing, he's so mad. Did you notice that Rebekah took somebody else's in the family's clothes and put them on her other son? There's only one other time that happens in the Bible, so that's important. Remember that. So Jacob, when Esau finds out that he stole that from him, he swears, I'm going to kill him the next time I see him. And he's pretty good at killing things, so Jacob has to run off. He runs off to a far country, and while he's on the road, there's this bizarre story about how God comes and wrestles Jacob all night long. And eventually, Jacob will not let go of God. And so God says, I'm going to give you a new name. Your name will now be Israel. Today, people know it as a nation state, but before it was that, it was a dude, a guy who was originally named Jacob. And what was originally one man eventually became a giant family and eventually a nation, and they lived up to their name. Eventually, because of a famine, they would migrate to Egypt, where they wound up in slavery for hundreds of years. And then God sent a prophet to go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people, the Israelite people, go. They're not going to live like this one more day. God delivers the Israelites from slavery, and the rest is literally history. It's the first half of your Bible. It's all about their history. They have leaders, some of them good, a lot of them were corrupt. And for every corrupt leader, God would raise up a prophet to rail against them. Interestingly enough, God often refers to his leaders as shepherds. And he critiques the shepherds often because he's saying, my people are like sheep. Now, a lot of you, if you grew up in church, you are familiar with that language. At the end of this service, I'm going to invite our shepherds to stand up in the aisles to pray for our sheep, us. How many of you have ever spent time with sheep? Show of hands. A couple of you? You know this is offensive. I had sheep. Those are the dumbest, most anxious animals on God's green earth. This is an example of how dumb sheep are and why the people who first read that wouldn't have thought this is like a precious moments, warm, sentimental thing to call God's people. So in Turkey in 2006, there was a sheep that a bunch of shepherds had, like a couple thousand sheep they were grazing, and there was a cliff, and one sheep ran off the cliff. And so all the other sheep started following him. 1,500 sheep ran off this giant cliff. The good news is that only the first 450 died because the rest of them started bouncing on this giant pile of wool and just kind of landed on the bottom. But that's how dumb sheep are. And God calls us sheep. Over and over again, he says you need a shepherd. And sometimes, a lot of times, Israel's leaders were bad shepherds. And so there are places like in Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, or the prophet Ezekiel, where he would say, you know what? Your shepherds aren't doing what they're supposed to do. And look, interestingly enough, at what God's critique of bad shepherding looked like, of bad Christian leadership. Look at this. In Ezekiel chapter 34, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, or Ezekiel, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourself. Should not the shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, you clothe yourself with the wool, you slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them brutally and harshly. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains and over every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched for them, and no one looked for them. And then verse 11, for this is what the sovereign Lord says, I myself will search for my sheep, and I will look after them. The shepherds, the leaders, aren't doing their job. They're using their positions to take care of themselves, but no one searched for, did you catch that? The lost sheep. So God says, I will become their shepherd. I will come and do what these bad religious leaders won't do. And that leads us to the Gospel of Luke and really the heart of God. Because Jesus is God in the flesh, and he comes on the scene doing exactly what God always promised to do. Have you ever noticed that religious people can so easily lose sight of what's really important to God? The religious leaders of their day, of Jesus' day, are not much different than religious leaders today. They know how to argue about obscure stuff. Back in Jesus' day, the obscure stuff was the same. It made them feel smart, made them feel self-righteous. It was the best way to wash your hands or keep your Sabbath. And that's not our stuff. But don't we do that? Argue about obscure stuff that didn't make the list in Ezekiel about what really matters to God? And the religious leaders, check this out, the religious leaders in Jesus' day, they thought they were serving and honoring and revering God, but it turns out they were so far from the heart of God that when God showed up, they didn't like him at all. So with that in mind, turn to the best chapter in your Bible, Luke chapter 15. Verse 1. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. You hear it? The backdrop for all this chapter is that. Jesus is going to tell three back-to-back stories responding to that. They don't like that Jesus spends time with sinners. By the way, you're a sinner. You're not just a sinner, but that's part of what you are. So aren't you glad Jesus told these stories that changed the world, and if you'll let them, can change your world this morning. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulder and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my sheep." I tell you, in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who do not need to repent. See, there's a bad shepherd, one who lets sheep wander off, and the good shepherd comes in, just like Ezekiel promised God would one day do, and goes to any lengths to find the sheep. This is not a sentimental story. This is a sacrifice. A sheep, an average sheep, weighs like 60 pounds. The shepherd is carrying this thing over hills and valleys. And the picture of this is not a shepherd who's complaining, but rejoicing. This is a God who is happy to sacrifice to find people who are lost. You know what? You can tell a lot about people by how they celebrate and what they celebrate. I know, listen, I'm an Arkansan. I am from here. When I was 15 years old, I went to an Arkansas-Auburn game that had, in War Memorial Stadium, the first half we were up 28-0. We, for some reason, were in the student section as a 15-year-old. I realize now that was a bad place for us to have tickets. But the first half, it was great. And the second half, Razorbacks didn't score again. And Auburn did. They scored 27 unanswered points. And in the last 30 seconds, they had the ball on the 30-yard line. And it was like 4th and 10. And they lined up for a field goal. And as time expired, they kicked it. And they missed it. And we had something to cheer about. So much so that this very, I don't know how you say it, not sober fraternity guy in front of me, whose name was Bill, I found out his name was Bull because we got really close in the next 2 minutes, picks me up, this total stranger, and dances around the little section in War Memorial. That's how you celebrate when something really brings you joy. You can tell a lot about somebody by how they celebrate and what they celebrate. And I'd like to know, what do we celebrate? Do we celebrate what God does really? Are our worship gatherings characterized as people who really celebrate what God has done and is doing? The tone of this whole chapter is joy. Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem to do what, church? Somebody tell me, what's he going to do in Jerusalem? He's going to die. And yet the whole tone of this chapter is Jesus saying, God, I am happy to do this. Who do you think needs God? You're complaining about sinners being around. Who do you think God is looking for? And when he says there's more joy about one person repenting than 99 people who don't need repentance, if you know the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, the main point is there are no people who don't need repentance. From the start to finish of the Bible, it would say everybody needs repentance. There's not just one lost sheep in this story. There's 100. Only 99 of them don't know they're lost. This story... Can you hand me my water? I do not need to drink coffee before I preach. This story is exactly what God said he would one day do, what the religious leaders of his day were not doing. Then Jesus tells a story about a woman who loses. She's got 10 silver coins, and she loses one of them. And she goes through the whole house. She's so excited about, focused in on finding this coin. And when she does, look at what she says in Luke chapter 15:9. When she finds the coin, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." And Jesus once again says, look, this gives God joy. Some of us think what gives God joy is getting church right. Some of us think it's getting our doctrines precise. Don't worry, we're not the first ones to think that. But when God was explaining God to the people, he said, this is what makes me happy. When a lost person is found, when a person repents, when someone who is lost becomes found. And then it says, Jesus continued. In verse 11, Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. And not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in wild living. So Before we go on, you need to know how awful it was that this guy did this, this younger son did this. Jesus is telling this story on purpose because it's the worst thing a human being could do in his world. Not just because he asked for all his money, but because he squandered it on the Gentiles. Back in the day of Jesus telling this story, there was a Jewish ceremony called the Kazuzah, which is fun to say and horrible to have happen to you. It's where it was, if you went off and spent Jewish money and you blew it in among the Gentiles, here's what would happen. When you came back, they would gather together the village, which you know, knew very well, your neighborhood. They would gather together the people, and they would everybody would bring some nuts and some burned corn, and they would put it in a clay pot, and they would break it, and they would yell, "Your name is cut off from his people." Because you don't blow Jewish money among the Gentiles. That meant when the young son did this, he knows he's not coming back. And in verse 14, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" This chapter starts off with the religious leaders thinking, you know what this guy's problem is he doesn't get sin. And Jesus basically in this chapter is saying, gentlemen, I understand you think I have a deficient doctrine of sin. Let me tell you what my doctrine of sin is. Sin is like a young Jewish boy who demands his inheritance while his father is still living. He sells the portion of his estate while his father is still alive on it. Allow me to explain. He takes that money and goes away from the Holy Land of Israel, and he loses his money among the Gentiles. And in the end, he works feeding the pigs, and his life, it's so rock bottom, he eventually wants to be a pig. A pig, unclean, right? That's how bad things have gotten. That's my doctrine of sin. And the Pharisees would have heard this first part of the story and they would have thought, amazing, you couldn't have explained sin better. Yes, that's exactly what sin does. Sin destroys people's lives. It breaks relationship. It devastates people. No righteous person could have a doctrine of sin like that and sit down and eat with sinners. Who would do that? And Jesus' answer is a really, really good dad who really, really loves his kids. Verse 20. So the prodigal son got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servant, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine is dead and is alive." He was lost and is found. So they begin to celebrate. My favorite verse in maybe the whole Bible is that verse, "while he was still a long way off." Because the dad is going to let the son go, but he's never stopped looking for him to come back. And when he does come back, he runs out to meet him. He throws a party for him, puts his family signet ring on him, which was basically like the debit card of the ancient day. He puts his own fine robe on him. The only other time that happened in the Bible is in Jacob and Esau's story. And just like Jacob, the prodigal has an older brother who's upset when he comes back from the far country. In verse 25, "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing." I would like to pause and ask, how good is this party that you could hear the dancing? So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fatted calf because he has him back safe and sound." And the older brother became angry. He refused to go in. So his father, who's always looking out for his kids, went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father's, look, all these years I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, not this brother of mine, when this son of yours squandered his property with prostitutes comes home, you have killed the fatted calf for him. My son, the father said, you have always been with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate, didn't we? We had to celebrate and be glad because not just this son of mine, but this brother of yours is dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And that's when you hear it. That's when this whole story starts to come into focus. Because when you hear the older brother say, all these years I've been what? Slaving. You start to remember who Jesus is talking to. Jesus is telling these religious leaders their own story. The story about how they came from Jacob. An act of grace. God chose Jacob. God chose you. God's grace rescued you from slavery. And guess what, religious people? You're acting like the wrong characters in your own story. You who are stingy in grace do not realize how much you've needed it all along. You think you want fair, older brother, but you don't. You don't want what you really deserve. You want better than fair. The prodigal isn't the only lost son in this story. The one sheep isn't the only lost sheep. It's just they don't know how lost they are because their religion has protected them from knowing how much they need to be found. When I was growing up, a friend of mine named John, homeschooled, loved this guy, special guy to me. Grew up in church. Grew up thinking church was about getting an hour ride on a Sunday morning. God really didn't care that much about what he did the rest of his life. So he started doing meth. It became an addiction. And a couple of years ago, this guy that I love very much, when he was not aware of what was going on, his truck with his one-year-old and his two-year-old rolled into a lake. And they died. Maybe you've heard the story. It's on the news within the last year. When the attorney offered him a plea bargain, my friend, now that he was sober, said, you don't understand. My kids' lives mattered. My kids' life deserved justice. So throw the book at me. And they gave him 60 years in prison. But he's on fire from Jesus now because he who has been forgiven much loves much. And he says God has called him into a jail ministry. And that story is really sad, but let me tell you, all of heaven celebrated. A few years ago, I met Lori when we lived in Texas. Lori was a successful newspaper editor. She was doing quite great. Then she, like by all standards, she was an upper middle class person. Then she had an injury and got hooked on prescription pain medication. Lori kind of started spiraling till eventually she started having to sell pain medicine as well as being addicted to it. And one day she's driving along I-20 in Texas. She's got a trunk full of pills and she's not sober. And a Texas state trooper comes behind her. And as the blue lights pull her over in the rearview mirror, she knows she's going to prison for a long, long time. But the first thing she said she felt was relief. Because she was so tired of life the way it was. And when she was in jail, she started going to the women's Bible study and she heard the gospel. Even though she grew up in the Bible Belt, she heard it for the first time because now her sins were not hypothetical. They were real, and she really needed grace. And it's only people who need grace who get it. And all of heaven celebrated. Or what about the woman who grows up in church, and she never did anything wrong, but she self-righteously judges all the people around her who have tattoos and don't know how to show up to church on time, or don't know the Bible as much as she does, but secretly in her heart she knows she doesn't really love God. She loves looking like she loves God. She loves being right, but the idea of death terrifies her because she's worried this whole thing is earned and she hasn't done enough. The prodigal son story is a story about a father who has two lost sons. One walled himself off from the father's love by doing bad. And one walled himself off from the father's love by doing good. I have been doing this job long enough, I can tell you, I have so many names for people in both of these categories. From college students to senior citizens. And one of the great joys in my life is what happened when people who brought up in church kids, when they get the gospel again, when you realize the question of worth has been taken out of your hands, it is not about what you know and what you don't know. It is not about what you do and don't do. When you realize it's not about being better than this group of people or getting the issues right better than those groups of people. The question of worth has been taken out of your hands and decided in your favor. That's what the gospel means. You are a son and daughter of God. You don't earn this. You receive this. This is why this matters so much to me. Because not all prodigals need passports. Most lost people don't have super dramatic stories, and a lot of lost people don't know they're lost because they don't know what being found really looks like. Maybe it's because you're young, or maybe it's because you're old. Maybe it's because you're a low self-esteem, or your boredom, or the loneliness you feel. Maybe it's your attraction to bad boys, or the thrill of breaking the rules. Maybe it's a search for a mother or father figure. Maybe it's greed, maybe it's curiosity, but for a million reasons, we all leave. You can be living in your childhood home and still be living in a distant country. You can play the role of good son and still be full of hate and bitterness and self-righteousness. You can show up to church every week with a huge appetite for idols that maybe you're not even aware of, because not all prodigals need passports. And when you leave, you need to know you're looking. You're looking for something. You're looking for someone. We leave because we're hoping there's something else, something more. We look because there's some piece of us that feels like it's missing. But you need to know you're not the only one looking. The Father is always looking. And the good news is, it's only when you realize you leave you can realize you have to come home. Grace is only given to sinners because they're the only ones who are asking for it. I know grace seems unfair, but you don't want fair. It seems unfair until you need a little bit of it. So maybe the best way to know how in touch we are with our own lostness is by asking a few questions. Here they are. How well do you give grace to other people? Number two. How much do you celebrate when you see other people come to know the Lord? Number three, how much of your own comfort zone and entitlement are you willing to give up to see the prodigal come home? That's a good one, because that's what the older brother could not do. Number four, how much are the people who are drawn to Jesus drawn to you? Max Lucado, who was a missionary in Brazil for many years, tells a story about how there was this woman named Marie. She was a maid. She was a hard worker. She had a daughter. Her husband had died a few years after her daughter was born. And so she raised her daughter, Christina, all by herself. When Christina turned a teenager, she kept talking about wanting to leave their village and go to the big city. But Marie kept telling her daughter, "Don't do that. You don't have employable skills right now. The big city is a place that would chew you up." And furthermore, she knew what she would have to do for money if she went there. But one day, after Christina turned 16, Marie came home from work and Christina was gone with all her bags packed. And immediately, Marie knew where she went. So she stopped by a photocopier place and made copies of pictures of her daughter and went to the big city. And she put those pictures of Christina up everywhere where prostitutes and streetwalkers might be. Nightclubs, bars, hotels. But eventually, after a few weeks of searching for her daughter, she ran out of money and pictures and went home. But a few days later, Christina, who had changed so much in the months since she had left home, was walking out of one more shady hotel, The fire had been taken out of her eyes. And as she was walking out of her room, she saw on a billboard her picture with the words written that only a loving parent could write. Whatever you've done, whatever you have become, it does not matter. Please come home. And she did. To the older brother and the younger brother who are both out here today, of which I am one myself, isn't that what every one of us need? Isn't that what we want? Grace isn't fair. God isn't fair. God's never been fair. Grace, God is better than fair. It's time to stop pretending we're not lost. It's time to come home. I'd like to invite our shepherds to take their places in the aisle. This, by the way, is a message for everyone, people who didn't grow up in church and people who did. I'd like to invite our shepherds to take their place in the aisles. They're willing to pray for anybody, no matter what you got going on. Tough week coming up, difficult week in the past. And if you're here today and you would like to come home, if you would like to put Jesus on in baptism and start your new life, accept the grace that God is freely offering, I'll be right down here. You can come to me, and I'd love to talk to you about Jesus or baptism. If you'll come, all together we stand and worship this.